In just a few moments, I'll be speaking with former J.F. Kennedy Library historian Sheldon Stern about his remarkable book, The Cuban Missile Crisis and American Memory, Myths versus Reality, which we will be offering to KZYX listeners as a premium for a pledge of $120. Stern's book is based on the often rancorous debates and discussions that took place in the Kennedy White House between the president and his advisors over how the United States should respond to the presence of Russian missiles in Cuba in October 1962, discussions that Kennedy secretly recorded and that only he and his brother Bobby knew about. Far more significant, it would seem, yet less well-known than the Nixon tapes, the readers left with the inevitable conclusion that were it not for Kennedy's determination to do almost anything to avoid a nuclear war with the Soviet Union and his facing down the demands for a major military response from his generals, from his brother Bobby, from congressional leaders, from so-called best and the brightest in Washington, there's little likelihood that any of us would be around to talk about it today. Stern's book exposes the misconceptions, half-truths, and outright lies that have shaped the still dominant but largely mythical version of what happened in the White House during the last 2 weeks of October 1962. This morning you are going to hear from the very first historian to listen to all those tapes, recorded discussions, Sheldon Stern, when he worked at the Kennedy Library in Boston from 1977 to 1999. While there, he developed a special interest in teacher preparation and secondary school history education. In 1992, he launched the American History Project for high school students, a program to introduce students to the complexity of history and historical evidence, of which the book we'll be discussing today is an outstanding example. After earning his PhD in history from Harvard in 1970, he taught U.S. history and African-American history at the college level for more than a decade. In addition to the Cuban Missile Crisis and the American Memory, he has also written two earlier books on the subject, Averting the Final Failure, John F. Kennedy and the Secret Cuban Missile Crisis Meetings in 2003, and The Week the World Stood Still, Inside the Cuban Missile Crisis in 2005. All of his books are part of the Stanford University Press Nuclear Age series. It's my great pleasure to welcome Sheldon Stern to Takes on the World.
Good morning.
Good morning. Very happy to have you with us. Tell us, Sheldon Stern, after writing two earlier books on this extremely important topic, what impelled you to write a third?
Well, I became aware that somehow the real thrust of the first two books, namely that 13 days is simply not true, and other things of that kind, simply weren't getting through. I mean, people were continuing to say exactly the same things that they had said before. And so I decided specifically trace the participation of each major individual in the meetings in a separate chapter so that there could be no question about what Robert Kennedy said, about what Dean Rusk said, about what George Bundy said, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the reason for it. And I had an experience at Princeton University in 2007 when I was on a panel with Ted Sorensen, and I spoke for 45 minutes, and then Ted got up and said that I was wrong and that he had been there, that I wasn't there. And he went on to simply repeat all the myths that I had just demolished simply because he said he was there. And, well, he was there, but he was still wrong. That's all there is to it. Anyway, that's essentially the answer.
Well, what's interesting, you invite the reader to share these discrepancies between how the participants would later, such as Sorensen, recall their role in the discussions and what they actually said, but you're particularly critical of his brother Robert Kennedy, who knew actually about the tapings, and the way he portrayed or misportrayed his own position at the time in 13 days.
Right. Right. Well, that's the key to the whole thing. The key to the whole thing is that Robert Kennedy's 13 Days, a book which was published in 1969, completed by Ted Sorensen after Bobby Kennedy was killed, and has never been out of print, and has become the iconic source for On the Crisis. Certainly the documentary that 1974, The Missiles of October, and of course that movie that was made in 2000, released in 2000, 13 Days, are just essentially Bobby's book. And it turns out that Bobby lied. I mean, there's no other word for it. He lied about a lot of things, but most importantly, he lied about his own role in the meetings. And that's what had to finally be exposed.
It wasn't just Bobby Kennedy, but it seems the other participants who wrote about it also kind of characterized their role in a different, more positive way in terms of their participation. And in reading the book and actually listening to some of the tapes that are online, you realize the idea of the president essentially standing up to virtually all of his advisors, who, although they changed their positions back and forth, essentially, if he had gone along with them, had been a weaker president, we would have had a nuclear war.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, the argument that I make, and I think it's the argument that the tapes prove beyond it's simply an incontrovertible argument, is that that's what happened at the meetings. This is not to create some sort of glorified image of Kennedy, who clearly had a significant role in causing the crisis, namely with all the covert actions that were being taken in Cuba, including the efforts to kill Castro, which Khrushchev certainly knew about, and that was a major reason for Khrushchev sending the missiles to Cuba in the first place. But once the crisis had begun, Kennedy was the most level-headed, realistic, and shrewd person in the room, and the only one who understood that nuclear war was simply not an option. That's all there is to it. Of course, he was profoundly aware that a nuclear war could start, despite the fact that he didn't want it or Khrushchev didn't want it. And there were several things that happened during the crisis which demonstrated that.
Well, I have to acknowledge that I was one of those who at the time considered Kennedy's blockade of Cuba in response to the crisis an act of war. And little did I and other of his critics know that this was the absolute minimum that he could have done under the circumstances.
That's right. He chose the least hostile course possible in order to give the Soviets a chance to rethink what they had done.
And the level of criticism against him that was considered in his inner circle as an act of appeasement, equivalent in the eyes of General Curtis LeMay, who later was going to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age. LeMay compared him to Neville Chamberlain.
Yes, he did, to his face.
To his face.
Yes.
And there was, you know, Paul Nitze, particularly when Kennedy said that he wanted to make sure that the Jupiter missiles in Turkey were not fired in any case, even if the Russians had attacked. This is really interesting, that even if the Soviets had attacked the missiles, Kennedy did not want a response.
He told Nitze that if there is an attack on the missiles, there is not to be a counterattack without his specific approval. And Nitze resisted that, as you know. He resisted, which is amazing, but he finally did it. And fortunately, it never happened.
It's totally fascinating to read the book the way you portrayed it, in which you go to each one of the leading civilian characters and how they responded and how they changed their positions back and forth. And when you realize what you're reading about was discussions that affected the future of the planet, and these were the best and the brightest, and this was the whole military, the leadership of the military complex, Maxwell Taylor, and then you have Curtis LeMay, and then you think about the situation even today with the renewal of the Cold War, and a much more hawkish Congress. I was fascinated or disappointed to find out that one of my heroes, Fulbright, was all for an invasion of Cuba.
Yes, he was. That's absolutely true. Even though we tend to think of him in terms of his resistance to the Vietnam War, but in 1962, he felt that there should be an immediate military response.
And you had also Senator Richard Russell, from Georgia, who was also kind of exasperated because Kennedy was not the hawk that they wanted him to be.
Yes, well, Russell was very hawkish always, but his position at the meetings was, and, you know, if you read that section in particular or listen to that tape, it's quite remarkable. I mean, he really went after the president, and which he had every right to do, but you can hear in Kennedy's voice how difficult it was for him to respond to that, and that he was clearly angry, but he never showed it.
over the years, there's been considerable controversy over the deal which led the U.S. to pull its Jupiter missiles out of Turkey in apparent, although not publicized at the time, quid pro quo for the Soviets taking the missiles out of Cuba. And it certainly was a major cause of concern for the executive committee. Could you run down the debate that took place in the White House at the time over that?
Well, I mean, the fundamental issue is this. On Friday night, the 26th, which was the second Friday, the last Friday of the 2 weeks, Khrushchev sent a long letter to Kennedy saying this was a private letter sent by diplomatic courier, and so it was it was not public, it was secret, in which he said, once you get around all the rhetoric, he said, yes, we will take the missiles out of Cuba if you publicly pledge not to invade again, which, of course, he was thinking of the Bay of Pigs. And the ex-com met the following morning at 9 o'clock Saturday morning to discuss Khrushchev's letter, and then were told within the first half hour that Khrushchev had made a new proposal, except the new proposal had been made on the Moscow radio and was public. The whole world knew about it. And that proposal was, we will take the missiles out of Cuba if you take your missiles out of Turkey. And that's basically the issue that was fought over for that entire day, probably the most fateful day in human history. And, of course, it was complicated that afternoon by the shooting down of a U-2 plane over Cuba. And Kennedy had agreed 3 days earlier on the 23rd that if a U-2 plane were shot down, that he would authorize the destruction of the surface-to-air missile site or sites that were responsible for the shootdown. But then when push came to shove, he refused, insisting that he didn't think Khrushchev had actually authorized the shooting down, which turned out to be absolutely true. Khrushchev had not authorized it. It had been done by a Soviet Red Army captain who picked up the plane on radar and decided to go after it on his own. And when Khrushchev got the news, he was absolutely beside himself, saying, how could anybody do something so stupid at a moment like this? For the rest of the day, the great argument was, do we respond to the first letter, or do we respond to the second letter, the second announcement? And everybody wanted to respond to the first letter and ignore the second. This is a great myth that Robert Kennedy created. But that was not what happened. What happened was the president said, we can't do that. It's impossible. It's not going to work. He said it over and over and over and over again. Dozens of times during the meetings, he said, we have to take the missiles out of Turkey. We have no choice. It's a public offer. We will look completely irresponsible if we don't do it. And ultimately, of course, he forced that decision on his advisors. Of course, let's not forget, Jeff, that the advisors were exactly that. They were advisors. They had no constitutional authority to decide anything. The only person in the room who could make the decision was the president, who understood that from the get-go. And ultimately, that's the agreement that was negotiated with the Soviets. Because of the political fallout, the possible political fallout, they insisted that the removal of the missiles from Turkey be secret. That is, the agreement to do it be secret. And it was done about 6 months later. And all of this didn't come out for decades until the conference in Moscow in 1989.
No, it's interesting that there have been some critics of Kennedy who say that although these missiles were going to be replaced and they were essentially useless, they nevertheless were loaded. And if they were fired, there would have been a disastrous effect. It's not like they were getting rid of something that wasn't significant. They were going to change them to the submarine-based missiles. But,
right.
You have subtitled the epilogue, What If? And you review the events of each day of the missile crisis, asking for a point of discussion, what would have happened if such and such an action had been taken that particular day? For example, you posed the question, what if President Kennedy had agreed after viewing the first U-2 photos of the missiles bases, to the Joint Chiefs' proposal to immediately bomb the missile sites, airfields, and so on in Cuba? What would have happened?
I don't think there's any doubt about what would have happened, especially now that we know, for example, that the Soviets had tactical nuclear weapons in Cuba, which Kennedy did not know. That wasn't revealed until 1992. And they were going to nuke the Guantanamo naval base if fighting actually broke out. And I find it, I think it's all but impossible to assume that if the naval base had been nuked and thousands of Marines killed in an instant, that Kennedy would have been able to resist a nuclear response. I don't think it would have been possible. There would have been a nuclear war. That's what McNamara said in 92 when he learned this. He said, oh, my God, can you imagine what would have happened? There would have been a 99.9% chance of nuclear war.
Well, they were quite concerned. Even Dean Rusk said the morning after the blockade had been put in effect that they were fortunate to be there that morning because they actually did not know what the Russian plans were. What's been troubling for me is that despite the revelations contained in the tape, certain prominent academics and pundits on the left still consider Kennedy to have been the ultimate cold warrior and do everything they can to downplay the significance of his role in mediating the missile crisis with Khrushchev. How do you explain that?
Well, it's the same thing is true of the right, of course, the extreme right and the extreme left. It's ideology is very hard to displace. And the fact is, there's one historian who has argued that to the point that you have made consistently. And then when it was revealed by Dean Rusk he says, for example, that the whole thing was political. The only concern Kennedy had was the congressional elections that were 2 weeks away, and all his moves were strictly political, and that's why it had to be kept secret. Now, of course, there is definitely some truth to that. But we now know through the revelations Dean Rusk made in 1989 that a secret agreement was made on late Saturday night, by which, in the event the Russians turned down the offer, and there was real concern that they might, for example, there was concern that Khrushchev might have been displaced, that there might have been a coup in Moscow in the Kremlin, and that the army, for example, might be running the show. In the event that was a possibility, Kennedy and Dean Rusk cooked up a plan by which Rusk called a man who was had been the deputy to the Secretary General of the UN, and worked out a secret arrangement with him that if the Russians turned down the agreement, that Utant, the Secretary General, would call a press conference and say that he had come up with a neutral third-party solution, namely that the U.S. would withdraw its missiles from Turkey, Turkey, and the Russians would withdraw their missiles from Cuba, and that the Americans had already accepted. The assumption being that unless the Russians wanted a nuclear war, there's no rational reason why they wouldn't accept this allegedly third-party neutral effort. Well, it turned out that Khrushchev had not been overthrown, and that agreement was never put into practice. But this particular historian, whenever he writes about this, continues to say what he said before and never makes any reference to this revelation, which, of course, as far as I'm concerned, completely blows away his initial argument. But that's ideology. I mean, it's the way it is.
One of the things that I'm still puzzled about is the degree which President Kennedy was involved with the secret war against Cuba as opposed to Brother Bobby. Because a couple of times in your book you mention how Kennedy pointed out to his National Executive Committee that the world considered the United States to be obsessed with Cuba. And I thought that was quite interesting. And so I'm just wondering at the degree the CIA had carried out the Bay of Pigs, although Kennedy had approved it, Kennedy did not come up with the U.S. Air support for the attackers, and this was considered a sign of weakness on his part. So how could you judge, what's your evaluation of President Kennedy's actual involvement in the secret war in Cuba.
Well, not the slightest question, not the slightest question that he was fully knowledgeable and fully aware of what was going on. Anyone who argues otherwise is, in my opinion, a fool. Bobby, the idea that Bobby would be running Operation Mongoose out of the White House with a $50 million a year annual budget and that his brother would know about it is laughable. Of course he knew about it, and he approved it. But once a nuclear crisis happened, he was much more level-headed than his brother and realized that nuclear war was simply unacceptable and tried desperately to prevent it from happening, even though Bobby was the lead hawk of hawks. So, of course, you'd never know that from reading 13 Days.
What final comments would you like to make about the message to our listeners and essentially to the public who listen to this online about what we can learn from that, those 13 days debating over what to do over the missile crisis?
Well, I think that, and this is obviously to somewhat a political statement on my part, it seems to me that the world changed in 1945 when the bombs were dropped on Japan, and particularly after the development of the hydrogen bomb and of course, the possibility of delivering these weapons by missile. We live in a very different world now, and the potential for nuclear war is always there. And it seems to me that we should always start with the least possible use of force in any kind of a crisis. There's always the possibility of turning to these things later, but Kennedy said on the 29th, the day after Khrushchev's agreement to remove them, he told the two members of the Joint Chiefs who had come to talk to him, he said that we can never use any nuclear weapons, even the tactical ones, because it'll get out of control. These are not usable weapons, and I think that's clearly true. But so far, at least, there hasn't been a repeat since 1945, but we'll see.
Well, Sheldon Stern, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. And thank you for putting this book out.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye-bye.